ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell here with Big Ideas, our live event show on ABC Radio National and the ABC Listen app. You know that question, where did you go to school? Or for parents, it often goes like this, where will your kids go to school? It's a vexed question because it's often loaded with assumptions and stereotypes and value judgments. So how do you answer it?
My children and now my grandchildren all attended non-selective, bog-standard public schools from kindergarten to year 12. I've been to university perfectly. I was told by everybody when I signed my kids up for, you know, a public high school in an incredibly wealthy, leafy area, that I was condemning them to a life of drug dealing and prostitution. You laugh, I'm not kidding. Unfortunately, they were wrong, because drug dealing and prostitution, I believe, are quite profitable. But it was quite extraordinary to listen to the kind of talk about schools.
In many parts of the world, going to your local public school is pretty much just a norm, not a parental choice. In Australia, school choice has been elevated to the norm. Backed by government policies and public funding for private schools. But at what cost? Today on Big Ideas, author, former advertising executive, Walkley award-winning columnist and popular social commentator Jane Caro, on Australia's school divide and how we've come to have one of the most segregated school systems in the developed world. Amongst her many books is What Makes a Good School, which she co-authored with former secondary school principal Chris Bonner. Jane was invited to give this 2025 Dimfner Clark Lecture, named after the linguist and educator who died in the year 2000, on Ngunnawal and Ngambri country at Manning Clark House in Canberra. Here is Jane Caro, and a heads up, a few swear words ahead.
Now, I hope you're all ready for a slightly bumpy night, to terribly bowdlerise Betty Davis, but I am appalled at the state of the world. I'm so horrified at where we have come to, and I've been thinking about how we've got here, what has led us, in the West in particular, to this awful place that we find ourselves. So I've called this lecture Divide and Conquer, because I think that that is precisely what has been going on for probably at least three decades. And I want to talk about the particular philosophy that I point the finger at, which has profited via division and conquest. We are living in a new age of segregation and polarisation. And of course, those two things go hand in hand. You first have to be segregated from one another before you can start to hate the other and say that they are fundamentally different and therefore evil. It is common to hear the left, not that I'm ever quite sure who the hell they are, being accused of driving this agenda due to what are now called identity politics. Try as I might to understand what is meant by that, the only thing clear to me is that it is most often levelled when a member of any group that is not dominated by white, straight, private school educated men seeks to name the kind of prejudices and barriers that stymie their attempts to live in this society as an equal participant. The response to women calling out sexism or people of colour identifying racism or queer people decrying homophobia, particularly at this moment transphobia, I am horrified that the honourable name of feminism has been hijacked to be so-called gender-critical feminism and persecute a very small and already vulnerable group of people in this society. That is a shocking distortion of what feminism is and always has been. Feminism is a liberation philosophy that aims to redistribute power more equally between the sexes, all the sexes, all the permutations of gender, sex, whatever you want to call it. I really couldn't care less. I think that everyone should be judged, I'm going to bowdlerise Martin Luther King now, be judged by the content of their character, not the content of their knickers. Call me crazy, but I reckon that's fair enough. All of that, the response to people decrying those kinds of prejudices, strikes me as bizarre. Those who scoff at such claims often accuse the person naming the behaviour of creating division. It seems they prefer the illusion of equality rather than the actuality. In Australia, accusing someone of racism seems to be regarded as a much greater sin, causing much more moral panic and abusive social media pylons than actually being racist yourself. I'm thinking particularly of Yumi Steins at this particular moment. She's had two experiences of that, and it was horrific to watch the way she was demonised. The idea that the modest, reasonable and heartfelt plea for a legislated voice to Parliament for Indigenous Australians was divisive and somehow setting up two classes of citizens willfully and outrageously ignored that the voice was an attempt to narrow such divisions and increase equality between First Nations Australians and the rest of us. It was perfectly obviously that, if you just cared to look. Particularly as the voice would only apply to proposed legislation that directly affected Aboriginal people themselves. That part of the proposal was studiously ignored by its opponents. A shocking 65% of Australians bought into the arse about flim-flam argument that acknowledging the particular plight of Indigenous Australians was the thing that would create the division, when in fact all it would do is force those in political power to have regard for the way their legislation might make things worse for First Nations people. It was an appalling, really awful moment in Australia's history, one we will be very ashamed of, I think perhaps already are. This arseaboutism, this topsy-turvy view of the world, is never more obvious than when you look at the rhetoric of, he's already been mentioned tonight, Donald Trump and his cronies. Wherever anyone's lecturing, his name comes up. Every accusation the MAGA Republicans now make is soon revealed to be a disguised confession. Even their obsession with pedophilia seems much more a besetting sin of the right than, for example, Hillary Clinton. The evidence around the Epstein files, particularly from the women who were victimised as children, though, of course, who can believe them? What would they know? Some man has to have written it down somewhere in a very important-sounding file for us to take any evidence seriously. And the ever-growing number of right-wing Christian US politicians facing charges of sex and child abuse surprises even a lefty feminist like me. I mean, I kind of can't get over the blatant hypocrisy of accusing other people of doing, they're actually talking about lowering the marriage age in some states in America now to 14, whilst claiming to hate pedophiles. Right. What the right claim is being rigged, they are rigging. What they claim is being lied about, they are lying about. When they attack those they claim are undermining moral values, you can be sure they are busily undermining those same moral values themselves. And surely they must know this. But they've decided the greatest form of defence is attack, and so are slinging accusations about precisely to muddy and confuse the beleaguered American public. It strikes me that even their followers know what they say is grade A bullshit. But they don't seem to care much either. All they want is plausible deniability, and this is really awful and goes back to the divide and conquer title of this lecture. They want to torment those they see as their enemies. There is a glee in rubbing people's nose in, well, lies and rubbish and knowing that they can't do anything about it. Truth, evidence, facts, science, none of it matters anymore. What matters is the power to redefine truth the way you want it to be, even as Trump does, changing black to white today and back to black tomorrow. The unpredictability is the point. It confuses, but it also allows anyone to claim almost anything is true whenever it suits them. This is the new power to decide what's true just because that's what you want it to be today. As George Orwell put it, the party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. Republicans in the US seem only too eager to obey. I went to my 50th school reunion last year. The high school I attended, to my great good fortune, was and still is a bog-standard public high school in the back blocks of Sydney's northern beaches. I was part of the class of 1974. I remember my time there fondly. It was in the days when public schools were the only schools receiving public funding, although the rot had started. And our education system was the envy of the world. I even got a free university education. Some of you in the audience are old enough to remember that. Anyway, most of the 67 to 68-year-olds who gathered last August were lovely people who had lived good and interesting lives, but there was one school friend who shocked me to the core. She was a hippie back in the day and had been an anti-vaxxer for as long as I could remember, but apart from that nonsense, I'd always thought of her as a good and reasonable person, until I discovered at that reunion that she had descended into the quagmire of QAnon and was now a transphobic climate change denier, a conspiracy theorist, and a Trump supporter. I now believe anti-vaxxing is in fact the gateway drug for Trumpism. After all, if you can deny one set of scientific facts, I guess you can deny them all. Maybe you even have to. Maybe if you're going to say that evidence isn't true, then you have to say no evidence is true. I pushed back against her arguments as calmly as I could until eventually she lost her cool. I promise you it was she who lost her cool, it wasn't me. With a mulish look on her face, she said, "I'm not like you, Jane. I don't read everything and then decide that I am right." I think she meant that as an insult, by the way. I always thought it was what you were supposed to do. She continued, "I just have a feeling." And there we have it. Many of those who voted against The Voice, many who respond to accusations of being racist by displaying their hurt feelings, you know, hurling defensive abuse, even shedding tears, those who sputter about identity politics or misandry when confronted about attitudes to women or LGBTQI people, they are angry because your objection to their prejudices has made them feel bad. And they have been told for decades now that their feelings are as valid as any facts. This feelings versus facts worldview has created a chasm. Those who've been encouraged to prioritise and legitimise their feelings, no matter what, and those who are clinging tenaciously to evidence, facts and reason, which doesn't mean they don't have feelings, but occasionally they say to themselves, "Maybe that's just my stupid feeling." I'm entitled to have it, but I'm not entitled to use it as the basis on which to treat other people or as a worldview. In my view, this chasm was the inevitable result of neoliberalism, a pernicious philosophy I objected to from the first minute I first realised what it was. It is, of course, the worship of the rights of the individual above the rights of the community, the rights of the market, which is the only community that it actually recognises, which, as someone who worked for 35 years in advertising agencies, I understand what a market is. It's a vehicle of exploitation and commerce. It's not a community, okay? My right versus our responsibility, or my individual feelings versus your collective evidence. As is being said increasingly now, everyone is entitled to their own opinion. What they've missed is that does not entitle them to their own facts. Don't get me wrong, there are many situations where individual rights matter a great deal, particularly when it comes to saying what you think without fear of those in power exacting retribution, even if what you say is critical of them. Or when it comes to voicing an unpopular opinion, even just a different opinion, a new way of interpreting facts, or a new set of facts altogether, as long as you've got evidence for them. It's not that the rights of the individual don't matter, it's that the rights of some individuals, usually the wealthier and the more powerful, should not take precedence over everyone else, particularly when all the evidence is against them. And this is what a slavish commitment to the individual over the collective has created. Just like the slavish adherence to the rights of the collective over the individual led to gulags and oppression, so its opposite, the freedom pendulum swinging too far, if you like, has led to alligator Alcatraz and oppression. This idea that whatever you get or don't get in this life is entirely your own responsibility is the philosophy of the lucky, the already advantaged and the wealthy. Oh, and the emotionally immature. Mostly, it seems, I'm afraid to say this, and I excuse everyone in this room, unless you reveal yourself to be different in question time, it seems the white, the male and the private school educated. I have watched this philosophy wreak havoc on all sorts of sectors in our society. I have watched with increasing dread the collapse of union membership, our tax base, public services, public assets, the inability to tackle climate change, the rise of the consultant, the gig worker, and the casualisation of work and the marginalisation of the vulnerable. It is a philosophy that divides the world into winners and losers. So is it any wonder that it and its delinquent younger brother, libertarianism, has created a society which is becoming nastier, crueler, and more bigoted, but also fragile, stressed out, and terrified.
Jane Caro, author, commentator, former advertising industry executive, on the state of the world as she sees it. Here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Jane is using this 2025 Dimphna Clark Lecture at Manning Clark House in Canberra to shine a spotlight on what she sees is the erosion of Australia's public education system.
A sector very close to my heart tragically illustrates the destruction 3 decades of neoliberalism has wrought. I have watched in real dismay, in real pain, as this pitiless view of society has absolutely gutted Australia's public education system, of which I remain both a proud product and a committed supporter. It is neoliberalism that has put parental choice at the centre of Australia's education system. It is neoliberalism that has drained the joy and the affordability out of early childhood education, out of schools and post-school education. And tragically, Australia has guzzled the neoliberal blandishments around education much more greedily than any other comparable country. We are alone in the way we differentially educate our children. What has happened to us, and particularly to our most vulnerable and most needy young people, could be used as an awful warning about what to avoid when planning an education system. Instead, it is becoming a model, at least for Trump's America. What the far-right Christian nationalist Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 recommends for US schooling is similar to what Australia has enjoyed for the past 25 years. They recommend a voucher system, so beloved of those who either cannot understand or despise the difference between equality and equity. Australia already has an ersatz voucher system, with the public money going to schools rather than direct to parents. The zero-sum game of neoliberalism, the idea that if for you to rise, others must fall. Remember Scott Morrison's remark about wanting to see women rise, but not at the expense of men? Not sure whose expense... anyway, let's not go into that. It's just a bloody stupid thing to say. Has had terrible effects on our education system. Parents have been persuaded that unless they buy the best education they can afford, freedom, after all, now meaning freedom to choose in a market, their child will be doomed to be left behind or fall through the cracks or get in with the wrong crowd. I've always been fascinated at how the wrong crowd are always orphans. No one's ever the parent of anyone in the wrong crowd. Their poor innocent child just got in with them. We have literally been taught to fear our neighbours' children and suspect that they are bad influences, especially if they are black, Islamic or poor. The idea that my kid must step on the heads of other kids to get ahead has been a very important part of the divide and conquer mentality we now find ourselves facing. What's that old shibboleth? A society divided against itself can only fall. Well, we have divided our children every which way over the last quarter century, and we are now reaping what we sowed. Our children are divided, especially when they get to secondary school, by gender, by religion, by academic ability or lack thereof, and increasingly by musical, sporting and dramatic ability. We increasingly put Muslim kids with Muslim kids, Jewish kids with Jewish kids, Catholic kids with... Actually, no, that's not working. There's hardly any Catholics in Catholic schools anymore. But that's... Let me go on. Smart kids with smart kids, dumb kids with dumb kids, and most damaging of all, rich kids with rich kids and poor kids with poor kids. Ross Gittins made a bleak joke recently when he asked, what did the Barker boy say to the poor kid? Nothing. They never met. And that's where we're at. Oh, of course, there is a way that they might meet a poor kid if they do that privileged young person's version of poverty tourism and go build an orphanage in a poor, unsuspecting, developing country to broaden their horizons. I think Prince Harry did that. I'm sure his horizons are very broad. Remember when it was revealed that a lot of those orphanages were a scam and a really damaging scam as well, so that we're using poor kids to benefit our privileged children's view of the world. I mean, it's beyond revolting. It has no moral... It's morally repugnant, actually, to do that. I have been kicked out of dinner parties for saying that, by the way. There are many problems that come from putting parental choice at the centre of education policy, not least that education is not for parents, but for children, regardless of who their parents are. However, the most egregious is how it turns the purpose of universal, free, compulsory education for every child on its head. Because all parental choice can do is entrench generational privilege and underprivilege. It can do nothing else. And indeed, that is exactly what it has done. But why can it do nothing else? Why is this result so inescapable? Well, it's because no child is disadvantaged through any of their own doing. They are disadvantaged and indeed advantaged because they've been born to parents who have either been less or more adept at navigating their way through society than some other kids' parents. Some kids, after all, are card-carrying members of the Lucky Sperm Club. The aforementioned Donald J. Trump comes to mind. Rupert Murdoch, Gina Reinhardt, they also spring to mind. It's a very unfortunate feeling when they spring to mind. They no more deserve their good fortune than a child born to a junkie in insecure accommodation deserves their bad fortune. We can blame or congratulate their parents if we choose, but that's ignoring that they were probably also born into more or less lucky circumstances. But we cannot blame or congratulate the child, although, of course, we do. Think of it this way. Can we blame girls being born in Afghanistan right now for their fate? Only if we are both heartless and, of course, more concerned about our own discomfort than their tragedy. Thinking about the brutal theocracy of Afghanistan, and frankly, is there any other kind? All theocracies are brutal. There are religious philosophies that promote the idea that the sins of the father are visited upon the children, or that your God somehow judges your worth pre-birth and chooses your good or bad fortune accordingly. A more self-congratulatory religious belief I have yet to discover. But sadly, that doesn't mean there isn't one. There may be, I just haven't discovered it yet. Not only that, of course, but just a few moments thought will tell you that a compulsory free public education system for all and a system driven by parental choice, given that parents all tend to choose and reject the same schools, are directly and logistically at loggerheads. They actually cannot operate effectively together. If we try to do both, as our education system emphatically proves, all you can do is create a parasitic relationship between the private school system and its host public school system. The lifeblood that is being drained is that of our most vulnerable children. No education system will ever be perfectly equitable. There will always be differences according to postcode and family background. The greatest predictor of educational success globally is not ownership of the school, but the socioeconomic background of the family, and interestingly, the education level of the mother. These differences will probably always be with us to a greater or lesser extent. In most of the rest of the Western world, however imperfectly, education funding has generally been used to try and close the inevitable inequalities visited upon each of us at birth. But not in Australia. Oh no. We are an outlier when it comes to using our educational funding, both public and private, to drive those opportunity gaps as wide as we possibly can. Indeed, Australia now has the dubious distinction of being one of the OECD countries with the highest concentrations of disadvantaged children in disadvantaged schools. And the OECD is now warning us that concentration is increasing at the second fastest rate. We are rushing helter-skelter to the bottom. As even Federal Education Minister Jason Clare has admitted, we now have one of the most segregated education systems in the Western world. And it is segregated largely along class lines. You know how we always like to say we're a classless society? Don't make me laugh. And for what reason have we divided our children? What benefits has this neoliberal education system delivered? It's not improved our results. The results of the more privileged children, most of whom have been creamed off from the public school system altogether, have not risen. In fact, they have flatlined. According to education researcher Chris Bonner, there appears to be no academic advantage in gathering all of the better off or better performing kids together. Indeed, I've often worried about all those bright kids who are in the top class in their mainstream school, who find themselves below average in their selective school, a school they fought so hard to the point of hysterics, mostly on the part of parents, of course, to get into. And being below average, that's 50% of them. And I'm hoping this audience is smart enough to realise that that's inevitable. It has to be like that. It has, however, taken a terrible toll on the academic performance of our most disadvantaged kids, whose results have nosedived. As Lindsay Connors, retired former schools commissioner, pointed out in the 2023 Improving Outcomes for All report, concentrations of advantage and disadvantage in our schoolish system have become eerie mirror images of one another. In the public sector, Connors said, 28.9% of schools had concentrations of disadvantage, while the independent school sector had precisely the same, 28.9% of schools, but with concentrations of advantage. So we have literally done this. Unsurprisingly, concentrating kids with high educational needs in chronically underfunded schools has a detrimental effect. In fact, it's why so many middle-class parents are deserting public schools. It is creating a vicious cycle. When the media talk about failing schools, they have it us about. It's us, the Australian community, that is failing our schools, not the other way around. Because we've had our fear and our anxiety about our own parenting manipulated into making us choose to leave the schooling system that is open to all and create, therefore, these detrimental effects for the children of families with no choice. Because choice is only available to those with the money to pay for choice.
The impact of school choice on the growing divide in Australia's education system. Jane Caro is on Big Ideas today, author, commentator, former advertising executive. ABC Radio National is where you're at. G'day, I'm Natasha Mitchell. And Jane is well known for her advocacy on the issue of public education. She is not holding back in this 2025 Dimfna Clark Lecture at Canberra's Manning Clark House.
The neoliberal ideal of isolating your progeny from the problem kids turns out to have little advantage for them, but cascading problems for the kids you are isolating them from. And again, it's pretty obvious why. You increase needs when you concentrate kids with various difficulties, the mad, the bad, and the sad, as I heard one exhausted teacher describe them, and see exhausted teacher just mentioned, you lose staff as well as role models. You become what is called a hard-to-staff school. You become stigmatised in the community. And kids aren't stupid. They know perfectly well they go to the povo school and will tell you so. That is the term they use, povo school. The shame attached to that creates more problems that already exhausted teachers are then blamed for not preventing. And so guess what? They resign, or they seek a transfer, or even worse, get made an offer they can't refuse from the parasitic, publicly subsidised private school system. And we now know that poverty and the stress that inevitably accompanies poverty creates the stress hormone cortisol. And cortisol has a measurable effect on the development of children's brains. Yet still, we finger wag teachers because they're failing to overcome the effects of poverty with a roll of sticky tape and a ball of string. So even more of them leave. Some people, including those still clinging to neoliberalism, point to increases in school funding. They decry throwing money at the problem and claim this is proof that money does not help. I do sometimes cheekily ask, if money is of no use in education, why do the private schools want so much of it? The problem with the way we increase school funding is that we keep giving it to the wrong schools, especially when we have a champion of neoliberalism in power. When he was PM, Scott Morrison gave $10 billion in extra funding to private schools and nothing to public ones. Nothing. Even under a Labor government, their recent much vaunted full funding for public schools. That means finally funding them to their agreed school resource standard after more than a decade when almost all public schools were underfunded. All public schools in Australia are currently underfunded according to their school resource standard, apart from a handful, lucky you, in Canberra. And all private schools are currently overfunded according to their school resource centre, except for an unlucky few in the Northern Territory. The federal government is trying to do something about this. That's good. But even so, full funding for public schools will not come into effect fully until 2034, which means a child in a public school kindergarten this year will not receive a fully funded education until they are in year 9. And it is being tied, the funding is being tied to somewhat vague performance targets and various hoops to be jumped through by the public school. I have a question for our government. What hoops do the private schools have to jump through in return for their funding? The answer to that is none. Underfunded schools are stressful places to be. Nothing is more demoralising to a teacher than to know what to do. They know what to do to help a struggling child, but be unable to do it because of lack of resources. Stressed out schools and teachers create stressed out kids. Which leads me to the next exciting episode of the mess neoliberalism has created. In fact, I say it this way in the lecture. Stress and anxiety and a society-wide collapse in mental health are another delightful gift scattered upon us by the neoliberal fairies, or red-blooded neoliberal blokes, as they would prefer to see themselves. Mental health disorders have risen by 50% over the last 15 years, according to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. Ironically, the stress parents feel about choosing the right school, the criticism they receive about their parenting if they choose differently, is not, I dare say, helping to decrease that percentage. I would also say that the need to pay school fees to buy that right school is one reason why so many parents work such long hours in jobs they often don't like much or actively hate. Their kids would probably be a lot less anxious if they went to the local school and mum and dad were happier, home more, and less fragile, exhausted, and stressed. We are chasing false gods. Interestingly, most private schools are religious schools. But this may be where we get a clue about how to reverse the vicious cycle brutal, inhuman neoliberalism has created in our schools and replace it with a virtuous one. When I talk to school principals, which I do a lot, I often tell them their major job is not to continuously improve results. Nothing in life continuously improves. Any person who doesn't realise this is still very young and stupid. But the thing they need to do most of all is to reduce parental anxiety. That is the number one task. And the way it works is this. You remember I talked about a vicious cycle that's been created, not just in our schooling system, but I think in our entire society. Here's how to replace it, in my view, with a virtuous cycle. If parental anxiety reduces, what happens to their children's anxiety? Does it go up or does it go down? It goes down. If children's, students' anxiety goes down, what happens to their teachers' anxiety? Does it go up or does it go down? It goes down. And if teacher anxiety goes down, student anxiety will go further down. If student anxiety goes further down, parental anxiety will go further down. And it becomes a self-perpetuating, anxiety-removing process. And of course, because I'm talking to principals a lot when I talk about this, I say to them, if all of this anxiety goes down, children, parents, teachers, what happens to your anxiety? It goes down too. We're currently hemorrhaging principals because they're being asked to do too much with too little and for too long. I sometimes allow myself to imagine what our country would be like if we were to concentrate on reducing everyone's anxiety. Choice and its handmaiden neoliberalism drives anxiety, of course, because it demands making decisions. You remember when John Howard wanted us all to change our super funds because we're going to have choice, and absolutely nobody changed their super fund? We didn't want choice. We don't understand our super funds. We just want to be put in a super fund and be able to trust that they're going to do the right thing by us. Anyone tried to put solar on their house recently? Anyone looked at all the providers and wondered how to make a decision? Anyone tried to buy a can of baked beans in a supermarket recently, walked into the supermarket aisle, looked at the number of different types of baked beans you could possibly buy and gone, holy shit, I'll buy some spaghetti. Choice is hard. We don't like no choice, but we like limited choice. Unlimited choice makes us anxious because we keep wondering if we've made the right one. And when it comes to the school for our children, that's anxiety up the wazoo. You know, I wish they'd invite me to the economic round table. Fat chance. I'd have told them that the fastest way to increase productivity would be to decrease anxiety and help Australians feel more confident about their own and their children's future. You know, offer them some hope rather than so much fear. A bit of more carrot, less stick. They'd have so much more headspace for work if they were less anxious, for community, for parenting, for civic engagement, for creating things and making things, including better relationships and looking after their own hope, health. Reducing anxiety is a win-win, but neoliberalism doesn't like win-wins. It likes win-lose. And I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on the ABC, but they can edit it out. Fuck productivity. It likes to drive anxiety too, and so divide and conquer and to continue to accumulate power to a paranoid few. Exhaustion, anxiety and the stress created by the view that life is a zero-sum game is a wonderful control mechanism. We are literally too tired to fight it. It always interests me that work demands ramped up just when women went back into the workforce in large numbers. My dad was the CEO of a major company. He was always home by 7 p.m. and never worked on weekends. The company was very profitable. God knows how he did it. It must have been a genius. But they all did it like that. Maybe globalisation has made work more competitive and more demanding, or maybe constant inhuman demands that we all continuously improve and get more productive has done that. And of course, ramping up work to 24/7 has also been a convenient way to hold women back, the notorious double shift and all that. And that's another thing that our obsession with private education has done, kept our boys and girls away from each other, because private schools, especially religious private schools, and over 90% of them are, and high fee, I refuse to call them elite, private schools are often single sex. Now, I know a lot of my feminist friends like to argue that single sex schooling is better for girls. And while the evidence for that is inconclusive, it certainly isn't better for girls in the long run when they have to compete in a world that is still run by men who all went to the same handful of boys-only schools. Remember Tony Abbott's cabinet where there were more men who went to Riverview than women? Not that that was difficult, as I think he only had one woman. Interestingly, we are seeing many of the high-fee boys' schools wanting to admit girls for the first time. Why are they doing that, I wonder? A sudden epiphany about feminism? No other, of course, no other liberation movement. They still want the right to exclude LGBTQI and, of course, and perennially the poor. Or is it that their enrolments need a bit of a boost and they are feeling the pressure from the systemic and somewhat more affordable Catholic and Christian schools and so have decided to cannibalise nearby girls' schools? Or is it because girls routinely outcompete boys in education and high rankings on league tables, another awful neoliberal method of dividing kids into winners and losers, are indispensable when competing for the families who can afford to pay up to $50,000 plus per year for one child? Enrolling more girls will send their academic results up, especially, of course, because they can pick and choose which girls they will accept. If that is the reason, I can see why they haven't dared tell that to the weeping old boys picketing pathetically outside their gates in protest. Feminist epiphany, boosting enrolments or sending their academic rankings up? You decide. It is my view that neoliberalism has ruined almost everything. And I think that's quite reasonable. And drained the joy and the humanity out of the world. It is currently rocking democracy itself to the foundations as the tech oligarchy attacks it with its algorithmic acts. Just look at university life if you don't believe me. So how do we rid ourselves of the neoliberals with their scarcity propaganda and their obsession with surpluses, not that they ever actually create any? And how much everything costs. Neoliberals exemplify Oscar Wilde's definition of the people who know the cost of everything but the value of nothing. As we stand on one side of that chasm I talked about earlier, hoping to claw back some kind of future from the nihilistic billionaire bros who seem to have a plague mentality, we're all going to die in a climate change ravaged hellscape, but they want to die with the most toys. What can we do? I don't have a magic answer, though God knows I wish I did. I do think there are signs of hope, even as the political landscape gets darker and darker in places like the US. I think Albanese's emphatic election victory was a sign of hope, though my heart leapt the most when he echoed Canada's Mark Carney, Canada is another beacon of hope, by mentioning kindness in his victory speech. Kindness is not a weakness, he said. Well, hallelujah, at last. I see hope in him standing up to the monstrous Netanyahu about Palestinian statehood and the increasing numbers of ordinary people taken to the streets to protest the carnage in Gaza from Sydney, Japan, China, and last week, Israel itself. I take hope in the refusal of women, people of colour, trans people, immigrants, LGBTQI communities, and First Nations people to bend the knee and keep standing up for their right to their own identity, despite the blast furnace from those who cannot abide the idea of any difference from them. I see it in the dogged determination of local communities to fight the fossil fuel lobby, to fight for native habitat, local forests, and against the ghastly colonial idea, Liebert's about this, that man, and I use that word deliberately, has dominion over this planet and may use and abuse everything on it for his own purposes. I see the possibilities for reducing exhaustion, poverty, anxiety and misery in a universal basic income, a four-day week, and the adamantine refusal of Australian workers to give up their right to work from home. I see it in the stubborn light that feminist organisations continue to shine on violence against women and children. They, like so many others, animated by their horror at the brutality of the powerful, simply refuse to shut up or go back to pretending that it isn't happening. And if it is, then it is all the women's, trans persons, queer persons, immigrants, black persons, poor kids' own fault. No, it bloody is not. It is the perpetrator's fault. Always has, always will be. Time to say so loud and clear. I know it can feel pretty hopeless at the moment. After all, I've fought for our public education system for at least a quarter of a century. I've written books, countless articles, made a million speeches, upset many friends, and discombobulated all sorts of dinner parties with other people who otherwise quite like me. Only to see all the things I've been warning about getting worse and worse. But what should I do? Give up? Not while I have breath in my body. What should we all do in the face of the new authoritarians, those who wish to rewrite facts, evidence and truth to suit themselves, those who wish to replace democracy with a kleptocracy or a theocracy or a horrible mashup of both? Bend the knee, retire hurt, or as I think many are doing, take the money and run. A few years ago, like many people, I watched with admiration and, yes, despair as the people of Hong Kong tried to stop themselves being horribly defeated by colonialism. They marched in their thousands trying to save their democracy. Many were, as they always are, young people. Their leaders were repeatedly hauled off to jail, and I imagine many of them are languishing in Chinese prisons today. I remember seeing one young man, Joshua Wong, who was one of the leaders of the pro-democracy umbrella movement. He had just been released from another stint in jail. It was a news clip. He was surrounded by the media, thrusting microphones into his face. What are you going to do now? One journo asked him. I'm going back to the protest, he said. But why? You have no hope of winning. We fight on, Wong said. with no hope of winning. And for me, that is the point. Who knows if we will win against the mighty and cruel forces trying to turn democracy into a relic of the past, trying to turn our planet into a relic of the past. I have no idea, but I do know this. We must fight on. In fact, the fight is the point at the moment, not the result. Because I also know this. If we fight, we may not win. But if we don't fight, we will most certainly lose. Thank you very much for listening and for having us.
An impassioned speech there from author, commentator, and she used to work in advertising, Jane Caro, on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and it's a topic that sure provokes passion with ABC Radio National listeners. I know that. If you'd like to share your thoughts on Jane's lecture, you can email us. bigideas@abc.net.au is our email address. And there were certainly plenty of questions for Jane from the audience at Manning Clark House, and here's a sample.
I don't see any immediate solution to the education problem. The Labor Party are as enthusiastic about choice in education as the other lot, from what I can see. But I guess the other point I wanted to make was that a few years ago, when I went to work in the ACT Education Directorate, I was given this Auditor General's report. And it said that in the ACT, which is, you know, one of the most progressive places in Australia, the disadvantage between one public school and another public school was as extreme as public schools and private schools. So I think this issue of equity is not just a public versus private issue.
It's not just, and there certainly are middle-class public schools. The difference, however, though, is, and postcode always makes a difference, and you will always have public schools that are better off. I'm not sure how the funding works in the ACT, but I do know that in New South Wales, if you're a school with a high level of disadvantage, you get much more funding than a middle-class public school in a nice leafy suburb. So there is an attempt in the funding that goes into the public system to follow to some extent the disadvantage loadings of the Gonski report recommended, but they're delivering too little funding, so that is the problem. But yes, you will always have differences between, and this is the problem with offering choice to parents, is that what happens is one school becomes the school that everybody wants to send their kids to, and it can occasionally be a public school. People in Sydney move house to be in the catchment area of what is called a desirable public school. Killara High School springs to mind, Willoughby Girls, there are quite a few others. Because school choice doesn't actually give parents more choice. What it does is it gives some schools, both public and private, choice over which kids they will or won't educate, how much of the disadvantaged responsibility they will take on. And putting that at the centre, giving parents permission, telling them that they're a better parent if they make sacrifices to send their child to a private school. Now, I'm sorry, saying you've made sacrifices to send your private kid to a private school is like saying you've made sacrifices to buy a house in a nice leafy suburb. No, you haven't. You've made a consumer purchase decision. That's what you've done. That's why neoliberalism likes private schools, because they approve of consumer purchase decisions, because somebody they approve of makes money out of it. So, yes, there'll always be inequities and those things can happen, but it is largely public-private. And that figure of 28.9% of public schools being very concentrations of disadvantage and 28.9% of private schools having concentrations of advantage is very clear evidence that it is largely that problem. And it is because we say to private schools, you can charge what you like and have as much money in the bank as you like and we will still give you this funding, no questions asked. Now, this funding was given originally to increase choice and to bring fees down. It has had absolutely no effect on bringing fees down, because just like the first homeowners scheme, they're doing it again now with the first homeowners scheme, like childcare subsidies, when you give public money to private suppliers with no cap on the fees the private supplier can charge, The private supplier does what Marketing 101 tells them to do, which is take the public subsidy, thank you very much, put it in their back pocket and charge exactly what they were going to charge anyway. NGIS is the same. I don't know who's in Treasury. I don't know why they don't get this. It's not rocket science.
As someone yet to have children, but looking at that in the next decade or so, going into a system that is so disadvantaged, obviously I understand the instinct to buy the best you can afford is the best way for individuals that are trying to be community-minded to boycott private schools and send their kids to public schools anyway.
Can I encourage you to do exactly that?
Yeah.
I have done exactly that. I have not just talk the talk, I've walked the walk. My children and now my grandchildren all attended non-selective, bog-standard public schools from kindergarten to year 12. I've been to university perfectly. I was told by everybody when I signed my kids up for, you know, a public high school in an incredibly wealthy, leafy area, that I was condemning them to a life of drug dealing and prostitution. You laugh, I'm not kidding. Unfortunately, they were wrong, because drug dealing and prostitution, I believe, are quite profitable. But it was quite extraordinary to listen to the kind of talk about schools. And I now say to people when they say to me, oh, well, the local schools couldn't send a dog that said, I always say to them, have you ever been in to the school? They never have. They've never. Oh, but everyone says. Oh, you mean everyone who sends their kids to a private school says that? Well, of course they would, because if you're going to pay $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, $35,000, $40,000, $45,000, $50,000 plus for something you can get for next to nothing down the road, you have to say that what's on offer down the road is absolutely shit. Otherwise, what kind of an idiot are you? So I would encourage you to do it, and there's a number of reasons for that. The first is, most public schools are lovely. They really are. Your children will be very valuable members of the community because you are an engaged and educated parent. Also, you will save a shitload of money that you can spend on things that would be much more useful for your children. To be quite frank, what I would do if I were you is buy a small parcel of shares with the money that you calculate you would spend on a private school education and give it to them when they turn 21. And they will be much more grateful and better off than if they'd gone to some Ponzi school. The other thing we did, not spending private school fees, is we paid our children's HECS debts. Not at the beginning of their university career, because we are not stupid, but at the end. So we have two daughters who emerged with no HECS debt. Do you know what a difference that makes if you want to get a housing loan? Like, I cannot understand the thinking of spending all that money and then the kids having this huge HECS debt at the end of it. I mean, it's just weird to me. So there are so many sensible reasons. The other thing is, if the public school in your area becomes the supported school of choice because people like you start to send your kids there, and there are case studies of this everywhere, the value of your house will go up.
And thanks to Jane Caro and to Manning Clark House for that presentation. That was the 2025 Dimfna Clark Lecture on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, big thinkers at the best live events. And you can find us on the airwaves Mondays to Thursdays at 8 p.m. and again midday the next day, or any time, of course, as podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. 4 new episodes every week. Thanks for your company. I'll catch you next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.